Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Pablos Holman on the show, founder and managing partner for Deep Future. Pablos, welcome to the show. We'd love to get an intro from you for the audience.
Yeah. Hi, man. How you doing?
Good. Good to see you. I think we haven't seen each other since Disall Summit.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, your talk was amazing. And I was, I remember just, it was like the best talk of the day. And I was like, okay, I got to have this guy on the podcast.
That's cool. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So yeah, would love to get that introduction so the audience knows who you are, where you're coming from, all that stuff. Yeah, sure.
So I run a fund called Deep Future. That's a deep tech fund, if you couldn't guess that. And basically what we work on is trying to find all the mad scientists and crazy hackers and rogue engineers and people who've invented technologies that can solve big problems and see if we can bring them to life. So we only work on these things at the beginning. Lots of them, so.
I love that. I love that because, you know, most of venture capital goes to software, right? It's all infinitely scalable. Yeah, 90% on the margin kind of software stuff. So walk us through your background, how you ended up being interested in deep tech.
Yeah, well, I love software. Really, nobody loves computers more than me. I grew up with a computer in Alaska in the 70s. So I got a very early start and then worked on, you know, using computers in different industries at the beginning of my career. And then like the 90s, we were working on, you know, trying to build the internet and all the things that we need to make that work. And I ended up working on cryptocurrency in the 90s and then AI.
In the 90s? Cryptocurrency in the 90s? Yeah. They had it back then, huh?
No, we did. It didn't, you know, there wasn't enough people on the internet for it to go anywhere. But
that's amazing.
The early days of cryptocurrency back in the 90s. That's where a lot of the important thinking and ideas come from. Yeah. Mm. So it was, you know, eventually I sort of steered off of just, you know, computer technology and trying to use computers to do other things. And in 2001, I got to help start Blue Origin, which is a spaceship company. And we worked on, you know, again, I was using computers, but to try to figure out different ways of going to space.
Wow.
And then after that,
so you've met Jeff Bezos then at some point.
Yeah, I started it with, for Jeff, right?
Wow, that's amazing.
And then, but there, you know, it was very early days. You know, there were only a few of us in the whole organization at the time.
Wow.
And so now they have thousands and thousands of people and big rockets and stuff. But that was a long time ago. So, but the point is, you know, we could start to, you know, look at, you know, what technologies could do on longer time horizons. And that really opened up my mind. And I started looking at, you know, how do we, you know, bring more of these different kinds of technologies to life. And that was about the beginning of the end for what I call the tech industry. You know, it really at that point became a software industry. And so for what most people's experience in the last couple of decades has been is just, you know, more apps and not a lot of actual technology. And so,
yeah, apps for our apps to manage the other apps.
Yeah, it's really true. You got it. It's, yeah,
you see the Lumascapes for some of these, you know, like I come from a MarTech background. Yeah. You see the Lumascape for a MarTech. It's like 13,000 SaaS apps or something.
Exactly.
It's so, like every app imaginable. SaaS is eating the world.
I remember driving down like 101 in the Bay Area. And if you look, this is a while last year or something, but when you look at the billboard, every single billboard is advertising software products to other software companies.
Yeah. Pretty meta.
Like API for this or that.
We got software to help manage that software.
Yeah. It's getting arbitrarily reductionist. So the point being, we could, you know, the tech industry's job is to bring technology to the world. And I feel like, you know, we just kind of got drunk on software. We've been doing that for
It's so easy to make money there. I think that's a big problem.
It's important. Yeah. We need to do that. That's all cool, but we probably should stop calling it technology at some point. And so anyway, in the mid, in about 2007, I went to work for Nathan Myhrvold. And, you know, he also had spent a lot of time on software, but wanted to build a lab to do what we would now call deep tech invention, you know, inventing all kinds of technologies in all different areas, science, technology, and go beyond just software. And so we started a lab called Intellectual Ventures, the Intellectual Ventures Lab. And we didn't know what we were going to invent. So we just didn't know what kind of lab to build. So we built every kind of lab.
So what is this? So what is Intellectual Ventures, and why did you guys start that?
Nathan had started the company previously to invent, but didn't have a lab. And so Intellectual Ventures was really trying to find a way to steer back out of, you know, the way that we'd over-indexed on entrepreneurship. And along the way, we sort of, I mean, Silicon Valley overall, you could say, really celebrates entrepreneurs, but along the way, we sort of threw inventors under the bus. And that's a lot of what's been the side effect of this, you know, this kind of a software focused thing.
Yeah.
And so the problem with that is, you know, we have good support to some extent for scientific research. If you look at what's happening in university labs and things, and that's really about discovering how the world works and those things. And we have good support for entrepreneurs, and that's really about, you know, commercializing and building businesses. But in the middle, you have to have an invention.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you're not really moving the world forward. You know, new inventions are how we get new technology, how we get new force multipliers, how we solve problems in a better way than the way we did it before. That's what invention is. And it turns out that's out of scope for academic research. It's out of scope for venture capital. And so it's this very neglected, kind of messy, crazy hair and a DeLorean kind of experience.
Mad scientist Thomas Edison sitting in a lab somewhere.
Yeah. And you know, Edison was, you know, arguably you could say like one of the last guys to try and do what we were doing, which is how do you focus on the invention part? And how do you scale that up? And so we were trying to do that. And there were a bunch of different things Intellectual Ventures did to try to invest in invention. But the part we worked on was in-house inventions in the lab. We got 6,000 patents on our own inventions, all deep tech stuff.
Wow.
And then in the lab, we would try to, you know, prove that some of these would work. And so we have all kinds of different things there that we worked on. You know, the most famous invention is this machine that can find mosquitoes and shoot them down with laser beams. But we also invented a machine to suppress hurricanes. We invented a new type of nuclear reactor that's powered by nuclear waste and everything in between. So it was a pretty cool experience for me because I got to really focus on, you know, taking what we learned advancing computers and computer technology into the world, but try to apply it to other kinds of inventions and other kinds of technologies. And so now, what I try to do is find other inventors and get them going and try to get them out of the lab and out of the garage when they're ready onto a more commercial track that's more venture compatible and use the machinery of venture capital, but aim it back at actual tech.
Yeah. And you could almost argue that's a return to venture capital roots. I mean, you know, VC.
I would argue that the reason it's called venture is there's supposed to be some Shackleton in it, you know?
Yeah.
It's not just a trip to Pottery Barn. Like you gotta be going for something important, big and new and otherwise, you know, you're just starting taco wagons. You know, that's cool and all, but
it's an app for taco wagons, actually.
There's an app for taco wagons now, yeah. Okay. Anyway, so I do get a little antagonistic at times and make fun of all the sass holes but it's because I really believe that we're missing out on solving some of the biggest problems in the world. You know, when you look at the tech industry, if you add up, you know, all the software stuff, you know, Microsoft and Facebook and Google, Salesforce, everything in the whole internet ecosystem combined,
yeah,
you get to something like $2 trillion a year. Well, you know, that's only a tiny fraction of GDP. You know, $2 trillion a year is good, but, you know, we have one company working on shipping. Well, shipping alone is $2 trillion a year.
$2 trillion, how much we're going into debt every year.
Yeah, we got durable goods. That's $4 trillion. We got energy. That's $15 trillion. You know, these are the biggest markets in the world, and they are untouched by Silicon Valley. And so deep tech is really about course correcting on that and going after improving the biggest industries.
What are you excited about right now as you look at all the moonshots and all the incubating kind of technologies out there? You know, one thing, you know, when I came to Silicon Valley, I actually wanted to work in solar. I was really, really into solar energy at the time. And one thing I realized with solar is it was doubling every couple, 24 months. And every time it doubled, it got 20% cheaper, which I was super excited about because, you know, like, if you followed it, followed the doublings, we were, you know, probably 2035 to 2040, we're going to have more solar energy than we can possibly use. Or, like, it will cover 100%. What are some of those trends, like, as you look out at some of these moonshots? If they work, they're going to really change society for the better.
Yeah, the way I think about it, most industries were kind of like version 1.0. You know, we just had to make them work. And we got them working, and we've largely got them working by, you know, just whatever was the fastest, cheapest, easiest thing to do at the time. And not that it was fast or cheap or easy, but, like, that was just what we had to do. And, you know, that you could say that that's true for energy. You could say it's true for railroads or even aviation. You know, we just had to make it work. But now we are a lot, I'm not saying we're smarter, but we know a lot more and we have much more advanced toolkit. So when you look at the real value of all the advancements in computation, you know, that helps us measure the world. We have sensors for almost everything. We have networks to bring that data back to giant supercomputers. We can analyze it. We're getting better and better at that. We're making giant computational models where we can run simulations. That's all much more advanced. I mean, really, in the last 5 or 10 years, we got to the point where we can do that for almost anything in the world. We can understand, you know, all the way down to the bits and atoms, what's going on, and we can use that knowledge to help us create much better solutions. So we can reinvent almost everything that we do with that kind of toolkit. And so that's very exciting. You know, when you look at, I mean, I remember when, you know, like, the railroads are steel. They're just all steel. Not just the tracks, but, like, the trains are also steel. The wheels are steel. The doorknobs are steel. Everything is steel. Just because, you know, at the time we knew how to do steel, and we just threw a lot of steel at solving that problem. But, you know, now we could, you know, we could revisit that and redesign these things with efficiency as a design requirement, you know, dematerializing these things, making them more efficient. That's a version of that is true for almost any industry. So I get really excited about that. I love the opportunities that we have to do that now.
How do you evaluate opportunities in deep tech versus software? Like, how do they differ?
Yeah, good. I'd say the biggest one that people often miss is that, you know, there's like two major classes of risk in venture. So in software, you're almost always focused on market risk. You know, so we have milestones like product market fit. What's that about? It's about figuring out if somebody is going to be willing to pay for your app. There's almost never technical risk, which is the other major class of risk. And the reason for that is, you know, technical risk is scary. and unique, and market risk seems more accessible. So, you know, with software, if you can draw an iPhone app on a napkin, you can probably, you know, probably build it. So it's not really technical risk. In deep tech, we're doing exactly the opposite, right? So we're taking a lot of technical risk at the beginning. We're trying to prove something is going to work that's never been done before. But once we get through that, we're usually addressing a vast industrial market, like I described, trillion-dollar markets.
Yeah. So we don't know the market's huge. The money's being spent there. You know it's huge. And if you can come up with a better mousetrap and a new way of doing things that's twice as efficient or three times more efficient, or the material costs are 3x better, whatever it is, you know you're going to have a huge market.
That and market risk is finite for us. And once technical risk is solved, that is also finite. So you're in a much better position at the end of all that than with software, where you have maybe no technical risk, which makes you feel comfortable, but you have infinite market risk because the market is constantly evolving and changing. Mm. So I think there's different dynamics for investors in deep tech, but some of them are very positive. Now, the markets tend to be mature. They have a lot of, a lot of efficiencies baked into them already. So the margins can be slim, as vast as they are. You can have incumbents that are huge that you're going after, and you can have a lot of regulatory capture. You know, these are industries that have been around for a long time, and they figured out how to stack Congress or stack the FCC or stack the FDA or whatever. So it can be very difficult for those reasons. So you don't always have a wide open opportunity, but so you got to be sensitive to those things too. But that doesn't speak to the fact that it's still very important, you know. And when you look at what's happening in most big old industries, you do have folks who are trying to make them better, you know, and they're trying to make them better 1 or 2% a year. You know, and as a deep tech VC, I'm not trying to do that. I'm looking for the 10x, 100x, 1000x multipliers. What are the things that could radically change that industry for the better? Because if we can get one of those, then we have something really worth doing.
I'd love to step back and kind of take a historical perspective on deep tech over the last, century or two, let's call it, since the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you could take it back to the printing press, maybe something like that. I don't know if that was deep tech, but what are some of the greatest hits of deep tech in your mind over the last, century or two?
Yeah, we live in a world of important hits, on two century horizon, we got a lot of them. I mean, we had the printing press by then, but we didn't have, we didn't have the telegraph even. Much less phones, much less wireless phones, much less transistors, being able to make any kind of computer, make automated switching for telephones.
And I think transistors are kind of the example of venture capital, investing in transistors, like the Fairchild and the Intel.
Because the first kind of silicon, we call it Silicon Valley because it's about the silicon used for chips.
Right.
Eventually, it'll be Gallium Arsenide Valley, or but the point being, it's So there, and there's the famous stories of Arthur Rock and Fairchild Semiconductor and the early days of what became Intel, and trying to make the chips, and that all ended up being centered in the Bay Area there. And I think that it's a good example of deep tech because, especially at the time, that was very deep tech. You really had a lot of that came out of Bell Labs.
Bell Labs, yeah.
Accumulated a lot of really smart people and let them kind of go wild with investigating these things. But Bell Labs was not good at commercializing these things. And it wasn't a context that lended itself to commercializing advancements unless they could be integrated into the existing phone system that they were building.
Like this example, and Xerox PARC would also kind of fit into that, where You have a bunch of smart people, a lot of research budget, inventing all kinds of stuff for a company that doesn't know how to use it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's forgivable in the sense that, you know, if your job is just like, you know, make the phones, install the phones, make sure that they work reliably, then, you know, what are you going to do with this laser gobbledygook? You know, I mean, it's just totally a different mindset operating a business than it is inventing a new technology and bringing it to life. And so venture capital thrived because it was a way to support a whole bunch of startups, right? And the startups thrived because that was the context that worked better for bringing these new inventions to life and commercializing them. And so, you know, I think of Silicon Valley as experiments. You know, every startup is like a $1 million experiment. We run thousands of those. A lot of them die, but you have to do that as a way of discovering what works, because the, you know, it really doesn't matter how smart you are. It's very difficult to guess in a multifactorial world, like what's going to work in the future. You don't know what's going to work in the future. You don't know what the competition's going to be in the future. You don't know what other people are going to invent. You don't know what's going to get a government subsidy. You don't know any of those things. So you can't really predict what the winning technology is or the winning product or winning company. Some of the teams suck. You have a falling out between founders. You have all these different problems. So startups are a way to just, you know, distribute that risk across a bunch of experiments and figure out, you know, which team can handle it, which tech can handle it, which product is going to succeed. And collectively, it works extraordinarily well. You know, sucks if you're one of the, you know, ones that didn't work out. But the truth is, even for the ones that didn't work out, you know, we tend to learn something. The founders have to, you know, suffer a little bit of PTSD and whatnot. But the whole rest of the team just goes and works for the next startup over that was working better. So yeah. Collectively, you get to the future that way, and it works really well. And I'm really, you know, a big believer in that system. And I'm not a big believer that, you know, Fortune 500 companies could somehow figure out how to compete with that on innovation. They cannot. That's why Silicon Valley exists. Mm-hmm. You know, R&D departments in the 80s all got their asses kicked by two guys in a garage, no money, no resources, no time. And so, you know, we learned our lesson. You know, we shut down R&D and replaced it with M&A. So now you have, if you look at the Fortune 500 or Fortune 1000, you know, those companies, they don't try to invent new technology. They didn't hire the kind of people who would be good at it anyway.
Right.
And even if they did, they would, you know, give them a stack of paperwork to fax off to HR to requisition a desk. You know, like it just doesn't.
Oh, I mean, we're putting cover sheets on the TPS reports now.
So. Oh, there's cover sheets now.
Cover sheets, that's gonna
help a lot. So, you know, maybe.
But that's an interesting. I think that's an interesting. It's one of the best things I think has happened in our society is this startup culture instead of finance culture. And I spent the first decade or so in finance. I had dreams of working on Wall Street, and I got there and I hated it and washed out.
Yeah.
But a lot of those smart people, instead of doing another financial product or whatever, decided, hey, maybe I'll go build a new architecture for language models, you know, or maybe I'll spend some time working on CS projects.
Yeah.
Because fundamentally, I think people are still kind of motivated by money, but they're also motivated by creating something for the world. Right. And I think Silicon Valley is better than anywhere else on the planet of, like you said, running all those experiments and figuring out what's going to work.
Yeah. And that's, I think if you look at almost, you know, any context that's successful at doing new things, under the hood, that's what you find. It wasn't that they had the smartest people and they were so smart they could guess the right thing. It was that they had a context where they could run a lot of experiments and get a lot of shots on goal and hit those against each other and find out what's going to win. And so Silicon Valley is really good for that. I think Wall Street is is good for that in a way, because you have, you know, usually there's some really screwy incentive structures, but basically you have the market and they're all playing the market, and the ones that lose consistently get washed out. But the ones that can figure out how to play and win at the market in some sense, are the winners. And a lot of them are very good at running a lot of experiments in a different context. You know, that's what's happening at hedge funds, that's happening in these trading organizations. But a lot of Wall Street is just bullshit sales.
Yeah.
You know, try and get people to let you manage their money and
yeah, and collect a fee on the management. Not VCs though.
No, VCs aren't like that at all.
Oh, we're not like that at all. How do you create value in the world? What are some of the ways?
I think it's pretty easy.
Not you personally, but just generally.
Yeah.
How is value created? Yeah.
Value is at any level is like, are you doing something that helps other people?
All right.
You could define that however you want. That could be true for you as an individual. It could be true for a company or a government or a country. You know, it's really about, you know, are you making the world a little better for other people? And there's a lot of folks doing things that are obviously parasitic. There are a lot of folks that are doing things that are, you know, kind of in maintenance mode, and maybe we need a little of that, but a lot of what's going on in the world is not actually advancement. And I think the advancement is very important because, you know, when you look at the problems in the world, a lot of times the problems that we have, the things that are happening that we don't like or that aren't going well, it's because we got ahead of ourselves. You know, we made too many people, or we raised their living standard too much, more than we could afford, more than we had prepared for, more than supported. And so right now, like a good example of that, I think, is, you know, in our lifetime has been population growth. You know, we have a massive amount of population growth in the last 100 years. We went 10x. We went 10x on population in the last 100 years globally. That's a lot of people. We have 8 billion people now. And you have to do, every person costs something. You
know,
they have an energy cost. And you got to provide that for them. And I feel like we made these people, but we didn't make enough energy to provide for them. To me, that's a real sad state of affairs for humans. Like, and we're not being honest with ourselves that each of those people costs something.
Yeah.
And we want to provide for them. We want them to thrive. We need to provide the energy they need for that. And it's not just energy, but energy is the most fundamental, you know, and that maps to, you know, clean water and sanitation and health and, you know, being able to construct homes and provide jobs. I mean, it really maps to energy. If you don't solve energy, you really can't solve any of those other problems. And so that's the other thing we're not very good about being honest about is, you know, how do you stack rank your values? What do you care about? You know, if we care about taking care of those people, and you would want to take care of them, you have to live in the same world as them. If you don't want wars, well, you know what? It's because we didn't provide energy for those people. What are those wars about? They're about getting access to energy. Oh, shit. Well, what happens in a world where we do provide that energy? You know, you were talking about, you know, a kind of Moore's law for solar. You know, well, solar is a way of delivering more energy to people without all the problems of, you know, burning coal and gas and things the way we did it before. So that's an example of, like, how do you take care of those people, provide for them? And in a world where people are provided for, then, you know, you could expect a lot of things to improve and get better and be more civil and be more fair and be more peaceful and all those things.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's how I think about it. You know, anything anybody's working on, you figure out for yourself how you get into that.
Yeah. Sort of worldview. What are some trends in deep tech that you're bullish on, and the inverse, also bearish on?
Oh, man. I mean, look, I think there's a problem in deep tech, which is that some of these things are very expensive in order to prove that they work. They have to go through a long cycle in research, and there's not enough funding in research for a lot of them. And so sometimes people start getting ahead of themselves and they try to access venture money when the research money isn't there. And so they start overhyping the commercial potential and they start delivering over-optimistic, you know, timelines for how long they think it's going to take to commercialize. And that's premature. So I basically start by categorizing every technology into one of two buckets. You know, this bucket needs a miracle and that bucket doesn't. So needs a miracle means we need some breakthrough in order for it to work. And that bucket doesn't need a miracle, might be hard engineering work, but it, we know that it's technically possible. So that's the first order filter. Well, when you look at things like quantum computing, that needs some fucking miracles. More than one.
And I what are some of those miracles? Because you keep hearing about quantum, but it just seems to be 5 years away perpetually.
Yeah, like a few years. It needs breakthroughs, and breakthroughs don't happen on a schedule. So it doesn't matter if you say 5 years or 10 years or 5 months or 10, you know, it's just you can't get breakthroughs on a schedule. And yes, we are learning faster, and yes, we're advancing faster, but if you need a breakthrough, you cannot put it on a timeline. And I think it's disingenuous to make those kinds of claims and to raise venture capital money for those kinds of projects because investors will be burned. That will make them sour on putting money towards other deep tech projects that could be delivered, that could make a difference, that don't need miracles. And so I'm pretty sensitive to that. I'm really pissed off about what's happening in quantum computing right now. Those are research projects, amazing scientific research. We should fund that and investigate it with scientific research context. We should not be applying venture capital to it.
That's how do you know when it's the right time for venture capital? That's an interesting distinction.
No, the right time for venture capital is when you get off of the research track and onto a commercialization track, right? Because venture capital, better or worse, we only have 10 years. So we got 10 years, every venture fund. I mean, there are very few exceptions.
Right.
You know, we're a 10-year fund. And so that means we got to provide, we got to commercialize, make some money, make the thing valuable, and then sell it within 10 years.
Right.
So, you know, that clock doesn't start when you're still in research. So every day in research is eating into your 10 years, and you haven't even started on the track of commercialization. I think so. That's one thing I think about. I mean, I don't want to just be doom and gloom here, but
yeah,
that's an example that you could apply to other things on using your own brain of how I think people lose their way. So, so I don't invest.
So we do need governments to kind of step in and fund the academics that can do the primary research.
For sure. And we need that. It's very important. And we should be doubling down on those things. I have no problem with any of that happening in a research context. The problem I'm trying to describe is when we have people overstating what they can do and when. Quantum computing, of course, is very technical, very complex. Very few people are qualified to understand it in the first place. And so if you can, you know, show up with a really fancy deck and convince some investors that they're all going to get rich, and they'll back it. And I think that's not going very well in my mind.
So you don't think you think quantum computing in this case is probably more than 10 years away? It's not. Oh, it's not.
It's worse than that. Like they don't. Like we don't have a quantum computer. We have like a couple of little glowing qubits here and there. They cost millions of dollars, and even if we could make them work, you need not just thousands, you need like hundreds of thousands of qubits to do anything useful. We're nowhere close to that. You have to initialize them into a known state, which we don't even know if that's possible. These are miracles that we need. You know, these are breakthroughs that we need in our, and before we can even get started. And then on top of that, nobody knows what they would do with a quantum computer if they had it. There is no quantum OS. There's no quantum memory. There's no quantum I/O. No quantum storage. No quantum networking. All of those things have to be built up from the ground up. None of that is going to happen in 10 years, no matter how motivated we are. And at the end of all that, you basically end up with a fancy coprocessor. And right now, we are at a point where we have so much potential in classical computing that remains untapped that I think it's a waste for anybody to be pining for a quantum computer. And so, you know, that said, they're very important in the long run for, you know, the list of things they're useful for is like climate modeling, drug discovery or materials discovery. Well, guess what? You know, we're getting better and better and better at all those things with classical computing,
right?
And the new approaches, and we're getting a glut of computation now that we can start to aim at these things. And so I think there's a lot more potential in that for the next decade than anything to do with quantum computing. That's my view. Obviously, yeah. I'm dissenting. Almost everyone else disagrees with me on that one.
Yeah, because so, you see a lot of headlines, right? You know, IBM got a working, bullshit. Google's got a working.
When you hear the word quantum, just replace it with the word bullshit in your mind, and you'll be on the right.
What other trends are you're bearish on in the current deep tech?
Oh man, you got to get me off the bearish stuff. I mean, look, I think that you know, another one that I get some flack for is you know, space tech. You know, having been at Blue Origin at the beginning of the you know, I guess I'm technically one of the first, I don't know, half a dozen people in the world working in private space launch. So I have been at this for a while, and now it's sort of caught on, and there's this whole ecosystem of people investing in space.
Yeah.
And I think you got to be very careful. You know, look, by definition, everything you do in space has technical risks, like I described. You're not going to get away from that. And when you look at the markets in space, all right, you got imaging. That's like billions, but maybe, but not tens of billions. You got communications like Starlink. Maybe that's tens of billions, but not hundreds of billions. And after that, can you even name a third market?
Yeah, it's like putting satellites in orbit, bringing them down.
What are those satellites doing? There has to be a market.
Yeah, it has to have a reason for being
military,
there. Yeah.
That's the one, I think the one cheat code is if you have a military customer, but I don't really like investing in things that only have.
What about mining? I hear amazing things if we can, you know.
Okay, good. So let's look at mining.
Yeah.
So mining has extraordinary technical risk.
Mm.
It's got to be dependent on a bunch of other things that have technical risks. So, for example, mining depends on launch. So if you say launch is solved, all right, well, now we're going to go put robots on asteroids and have them mine stuff. Well, then you've got deorbiting. That's not solved. How do you get the stuff back? Mm. You've got remote automation. Maybe you could pretend that we're good enough with robots that we could throw them on an asteroid. There's just a lot to solve there.
So much to solve there, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then I think, you know, that's, but the nice thing about mining is you would be serving a terrestrial market in theory, right? Because you're going to collect these metals from an asteroid and then send them back to Earth where they're valuable. And so I think serving a terrestrial market makes sense. So, for example, we do have one company that is working in space, and it's space-based solar power. So that is basically just take those solar panels on Earth. They sort of suck right now because of clouds and because of the relentless onslaught of night. But if you take those solar panels and put them in space, they actually get sun 24 hours a day. Space looks like it's nighttime. It's actually sunny. It's like noon in space all the time. It's sunny all the time.
Yeah.
We just have a bad angle on it. And so solar panels in space get sun 24/7, and then they can beam the energy down using radio waves. And this sounds like science fiction, and it really was. But all the technology to do that is practical now. We know how to do it. There are no miracles required to do that. And it's not even that hard. It's easier than a lot of other things that we do. And the launch cost of going to space is now at a point where it makes that very attractive to do. And so
what's the boost in energy per square meter on those solar panels? Like, is it economically feasible?
You get 8 times as much energy when you put the same solar panel in space.
Wow.
But it almost doesn't matter. You get so much free energy in space anyway. The only real number to look at for this is launch cost. And launch cost is coming down. So if you look at an example like that in space, how does that map to my previous claim of you know, how to evaluate these deals? Well, it's serving the biggest terrestrial market, which is energy.
Yeah.
Not only that, we can beam it from space to any place on the planet.
Oh, wow.
You can sell it to Africa or South America or the North Pole if you want. So you literally can serve any part of the terrestrial market. So it's a very, you know, that's one where I think it makes sense to be doing now on a venture time horizon. So I think some of those things are possible. You know, people are trying to do drug manufacturing and maybe semiconductor manufacturing and other things in space. And I think it may be possible to make a story for those kinds of things. But if you are doing something that requires deorbiting or reorbiting or hotels in space, you have to create a market. And so you have to solve market risk and you have to solve technical risk. And I don't want to take both at the same time with a venture fund. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Interesting. That's a very interesting distinction. Let's switch to a rapid fire to wrap things up. Sound good?
Sure. Shoot me.
This is my favorite part, actually. This is where the really good conversation happens, but we got into it a little late. What's your favorite gadget you've ever worked on?
I helped start a company up called OQO back in 2003. We were trying to miniaturize an aircraft carrier-sized laptop, everything that was in a laptop in those days, and fit it in your pocket. And we did. And OQO was the coolest gadget ever made at the time. We did a lot of the miniaturization work that now makes your iPhone possible.
Wow.
But unfortunately, it was too cool and too soon and too expensive. And so the company didn't work out. But
like, how much was it to create it at that point?
Well,
or unit?
When we shipped, it was like $2,000 machine, but it ran a full version of Windows and fit in your pocket. It wasn't, you know, it was like twice the size of an iPhone, you could say.
Wow.
And it could be your only computer. But it turns out that the IT departments didn't care about cool. They only cared about, you know, cheap.
So, yeah. It's like, well, why would I buy this $2,000 thing or $4,000 thing if I can buy this like $1,000 thing?
Yeah.
And it's four times as big. That's an interesting lesson. What's one technology you wish existed today?
What do I wish existed? Oh, man. Wow, I have a long list.
Top five, just start rattling them off, yeah.
Every other episode on my podcast is just me and my buddy talking about technologies we wish existed.
Oh, wow.
So you can listen to that if you want to hear them. There's a lot.
What are like three that come to mind?
I've been one of the ones I worked on years ago that still doesn't quite exist is I invented 3D printers to print food. I still want it to exist, and I
like a Star Trek replicator, something like that. Earl Grey tea hot.
Yep.
Earl Grey hot.
Yep.
Yeah, I would love that. That would be a game changer. Being able to take energy and transform it directly into food. I mean, exactly. Yeah, we'll get there. It might take a century or something, but we'll get there. Who is your biggest inspiration in tech?
Oh, man. Oh, man, I can't answer that one. And it's because, I long since became friends with a lot of people who were inspiring to me. And I think it would be
a disservice to choose a favorite.
When they're dead, I'll tell you.
Okay, I love it. Well, who's your biggest inspiration that's dead, not living?
There's some good ones for sure. You gotta say there's Douglas Adams for sure. Got a lot out of him.
Who's Douglas Adams and what did he do?
He wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right.
But also John von Neumann, for sure. I got a lot out of him. Mm. He basically architected the first digital computers. Wow. A lot of what your computer does maps directly to
amazing
to the first computers yeah. they built.
Imagine just trying to figure that out. Do you feel like in a different universe, if that exists, or a different reality, the computers they work differently? Or do you think there's one way for classical computing to work?
Would we have made computers with trinary if we had invented a three state?
Yeah, or just like a different kind of logical gates or something like that. Or yeah, would we have done it differently in a different universe?
I think you basically end up in the same spot. And the reason is you need, you need like Boolean logic. You need a Turing machine. Like,
there's certain fundamental truths to
to
how to compute. So no matter what universe or...
I don't think mathematics changes in an alternate universe.
So if we encounter like an alien civilization out there someday, if that exists, they'll probably
figured out mathematics. If they're doing anything cool, they'll have figured out mathematics. They may have figured out more or less than us, but they'll have figured out the same things as us. Mm. And even if physics were completely different, math wouldn't be. And so when you look at, computational logic and like how computers work at a fundamental level, it's just math, math, math all the way down. And so the problem we have is how there are a lot of things that we want to do that we don't know how to turn them into math yet. And so, large language models, for example, are a way to like turn language into math. It's actually a super shitty way to turn language into math.
Brute force. We'll probably look back and be like, that wasn't the most optimal way.
Definitely not. We know your brain is doing a better version than we do than deep learning, but we don't know what that is yet. And so part of the discovery process here for almost everything is figuring out how do you turn the stuff in the world into math.
Yeah. So, I love that analogy. Turning everything into math. What's
it's
your most
because then you end up with a lot of mathematicians and they're no fun.
Tell me more about that.
The mathematician's worldview is very math oriented, and so,
right.
They can't really hang out with anybody who's not also a mathematician.
So, well, it's basically there's this cascading perceived hierarchy of science
so
and math.
Once you get all the way down to math, then what you do is you do layers of abstraction all the way back up to, rock and roll.
I love that. What's your most unexpected source of innovation and inspiration for innovation?
I don't know if it's unexpected, but I'm a huge believer in hackers. I think that they have minds optimized for figuring out what's possible, has never been done before. I think that is very important. You don't invent new technologies by reading the directions. And so to me, the hackers are the ones like violating the warranty before they got the shrink wrap off. So I'm always interested in people who are very divergent in their thinking and
hacking stuff together, trying things. Yeah. I love that. It's like Steve Wozniak, right? With the Apple. Like
great
he's
example,
just kind of,
yeah.
Kind of hacked it together and yeah, and it was ugly and didn't work very well, but he got it working. What's a problem that you wish more entrepreneurs would tackle?
Actual problems.
I love that.
Pretty easy, guys.
Yeah.
if you're like building something that would make for a good episode of Silicon Valley's TV show, then
hot dog, not hot dog.
Just pick an actual problem, any actual problem.
What's your favorite book on innovation or technology?
My favorite book on technology ever was written by Danny Hillis. It's called The Pattern on the Stone. Probably out of print. It's very small. It's probably 75 pages, and it explains everything about how computers work from like the ones and zeros all the way up to massively parallel processing, but in layman's terms that your mom could understand. And so most people I know, even people with, you know, I hire PhDs who, you know, supposedly know about computer science, they still don't know how a computer works. So I think that's a very good book. One genius book. I really love it. And then I think, you know, on for entrepreneurship, I think that every word of 0 to 1, I back it. That book is right on, regardless of what you think of Peter Thiel or his companies or anything else.
Oh, yeah.
The only book that gets it right. I think if you're a VC, the only two books you need to read are 0 to 1 and The Power Law.
Mm.
Those two are I endorse. Those are good books.
Yeah, those are great ones.
And, yeah.
Love that. Last question. What's one piece of advice you'd give your younger self?
Yeah, it seems like I've heard this question before, huh? I don't know. You know, I think the advice that I didn't get, you know, like I said, I grew up in Alaska, pretty isolated. I really wanted to be around people who knew more than me about computers and technology. It was kind of a vague notion. And so what I did in Alaska is I rounded up all my skateboarding buddies and tried to turn them into computer nerds.
They
all ended up having careers in like IT and shit because of that. But they weren't people that were good co-conspirators for me. And, you know, and so these days I spend most of my time trying to be in the room with people who are smarter than me. Ask a lot of dumb questions, you know, learn as much as I can from people who know more and have different experience than me. You know, my podcast is just that. I'm interviewing or like having conversations with like the smartest people I can find. And
yeah.
I'd be doing that anyway. I just record some of those to share.
It's the same reason I do the podcast.
What's that?
That's the same reason I do the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a great hack for getting smart people to hang out with you.
Yep.
And so I think that I didn't know that that should be my goal as early as I would want it.
Hang around with smart people.
Yeah, you gotta.
You want to learn from. Yeah.
Find a way to be the dumbest person in the room.
I like that. Yeah. If you're another way of phrasing that I've heard is if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Exactly right.
Yeah. I love that. Well, Pablos, this was amazing. Thanks for coming on the Ignite podcast.
Man. Yeah.
This was amazing. Thanks again.
All right. Good luck. Hang in there.